Hey there. Are you tired of waiting for the next episode of It's Probably Not Aliens? Well, we've got some good news for you. On Nebula, our streaming service, you can get access to all our episodes a week early. That's right. You'll never have to wait again to hear Scott and I debunk the latest ancient astronaut theory or get a movie fact wrong. But that's not all. Nebula is home to dozens of content creators we know you like, so you can find all your favorites in one place. Plus, we post content on there that you won't find anywhere else. And the best part? By signing up for Nebula at nebula.tv/probablynotaliens, you're directly supporting the show and both of us. So don't wait any longer. Join Nebula today and listen to the next episode right after this one.
Happy New Year, everybody. It's 2024.
Yes, that is the year that it is.
That's the year.
It's definitely that year that we are sitting here and doing that.
We're not recording in the past when it's still 2023. Mm-hmm. It's a brand new year and you're doing great on your resolutions. You're listening. You're doing great.
Yep. If this comes out on the scheduled day that we put across, it's January 2nd, which is officially the day where you do all of the things that you were supposed to do on January 1st, but you didn't because you were hungover.
You do all of your resolutions immediately and you have to finish them by January 2nd. That's how it works.
Yeah. So I'm going to go and work out 365 times on January 2nd.
Perfect.
And then just call it a day. That's the trick. You just have to do, like, having a regular workout routine is for suckers. The new thing is going to be
if you just
do all of your life's workout in, like, you know, like a week, and then you're done. You don't have to work out for the rest of your life.
Yep. And then you pick one day and you do all your exercise and you're golden.
It's perfect. You know what? I feel like I put that out in the universe and then Joe Rogan's going to pick it up or something.
You guys hear about this new, I don't know why I went to like a pseudo Alex Jones.
I mean, if you think about it, that is another word for Joe Rogan is pseudo Alex Jones.
Yeah. We are in a weird space right now where we are actually, we lied. We're not recording this in the new year. We recorded this. We are currently recording it like a couple days after pretty big YouTube video essay-er.
Yeah.
H-Bomber guy released his 4-hour video about YouTube plagiarism. And so Tristan and I are in a space where we're like soaking it in and being like, do we cite things enough? Do we cite our sources? Do we do a good enough job at making sure people know where we got information from? And that is hitting a little bit home even more. Even more so because today's episode is another one of our
many
quarterly
corrections
episodes.
See, the thing is, H-Bomber guy, Harry, friend of mine, love the guy.
Yeah.
Every time he emerges from the woods with one of his videos, I feel like every YouTuber has like crippling imposter syndrome, and he re-triggers it every time a new one comes out. And this new one is like very specifically calling out YouTubers for a lot of the bad habits. Like, obviously it's about plagiarism and like the like blatant plagiarists that just made an absolute travesty of, like, you know, people's, you know, works and just like, you know, I the big thing is about how many like small time queer creators have had their words stolen and taken. But there's a lot of other remarks that are made in the video that I feel like were almost laser targeted to hit any YouTube creator and make them have some sort of anxiety spiral, target that imposter syndrome in all of us and just drive us absolutely up the wall.
I feel like the people like us who, it's funny because I feel like the people who don't care, like, right? Like the people who don't care about plagiarism and don't care about citing their sources are unscathed. But all of us who like do are now in a panic spiral of like, am I doing it good enough though? What could I do better? What could I do more?
Just DM Harry, say I'm a good boy.
Harry, please tell me that I'm doing it good. And so, yeah, I don't know. It's funny. I've seen so many people that I respect their work and I think they do a good job also being like, okay, but like, is there a standard format that we should all follow now? Because, like, I'm panicking. So we're all in this sort of weird headspace at the moment.
To give an idea of it, Tristan was a hunt the first time. I watched the first half of it, and then I went to bed. Woke up at 3:30 in the morning. Could not go back to sleep for the rest of the day because I was utterly convinced through a dream that I am a YouTube plagiarist. And that is even before the, that's even before the pivot to, what was his name? James something or other?
James Somerton, yeah.
James Somerton. And so like that was just based on the internet historian / Illuminati section of it. And so I was just like, but I think that's because like I think I just have general anxiety at the best of times.
Yeah.
And some self-esteem issues. And those are all being particularly triggered because of some stuff going on in my life. So it was a really great video, came at the absolute worst time for Tristan's mental health. And it just was like,
it was a big
explosion for me, but that's okay because hopefully the idea that when we fuck up, we at least admit it on the internet.
Yes.
That's what we're going to do today.
That's what these episodes are for. We do corrections episodes every 3 months just to be like, hey gang, we fucked up.
Yeah.
We did it again.
As you point out,
we're doing it again.
We're not Harry. We don't make one video per annum, so that our one project.
Can I just say, what a fucking cheater Harry is? Everyone's doing like their best video essays of the year list, and he always sneaks in. It's like Oscar season for him. He sneaks in right at the last second and always pumps out this banger of a video, and it's always fresh on everyone's mind, and it's like, yeah, obviously he's gonna win. Like that's just how it shakes out.
He even has an extended segment about best video essay of the year to cement the association in these journalists' minds. Yeah.
He does. Oh, unbelievable. What a cheater. I have it out for him, and not just because I'm also a bald bearded bi guy. All right. There can be two of us. He's so good.
He's so good.
Why is he so good?
Even when he makes a video like on Deus Ex or whatever, he triggers the imposter syndrome of every essayist I know. Because his stuff is just so good. But we make an episode every week, and we try I try my best to do as good research as I can. But obviously, I fuck up. And as we learn very often, it's because of just random shit I say during the podcast. So hopefully, this is my way of saying, hey, if somebody isn't speaking from like an academic press or like, you know, a journalist from a highly respected organization, be skeptical about the things that they say and don't take it as gospel, including us, because, you know,
including
I have several advanced degrees that make people take me more seriously than average than they should. But keep in mind that, you know, I'm just a person trying my best. And oftentimes in a show like this, I have to delve into a lot of subjects that I only know a bit about, and stuff gets messy. So all
stuff
that is
gets
to
messy.
Say, the first fuck up though is squarely Scott's, and I want to make sure that we all know that. Because
what did I get wrong
in an episode? In episode 65, where we talked about, I think this is the Battle of Los Angeles episode, is where we're starting.
Okay.
Oh, this is also a podcast called It's Probably Not Aliens.
Oh my gosh, we didn't introduce ourselves. Hi, my name is Scott. I'm the first fuck up, apparently.
Yeah, I'm Tristan Johnson. I'm the rest of the fuck ups. So that's
this is a podcast where we talk about ancient astronaut theory and ancient aliens, and we debunk stuff. And this is an episode where people debunk us, basically.
Yeah.
You get it. If you don't jump into one of these episodes if it's the first time you're with us. Go to a different episode.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to immediately command you somewhere else.
Don't stop listening to this podcast.
We have 100 other episodes, over 100 episodes. Listen to a different one.
Yeah.
Before listening to this one.
That is a good call. Now, Scott.
Now, I fucked up. What did I do?
In the Battle of Los Angeles episode, you referred to a 2011 animated film called Rango. In which you determined that this main character, titled Rango, was a gecko.
He's not a gecko.
Rose up to state that he is indeed a chameleon.
Dang it.
And the movie does draw attention to the fact that there are chameleon-related jokes in the movie.
Okay. All right. I mixed up a gecko and a chameleon. Ooh, big deal. All right. I'm sorry. I didn't know people had such strong feelings about Rango.
Yeah. I literally had never heard of the movie before you mentioned it on the podcast.
I watched the movie in theaters and I don't remember anything about it.
Yeah, I think that we all know that I have a pop culture black hole between the years 2010 and 2013. So there is that. But also, yeah, I also have a black hole for movies for my entire life because I am famous for being the bad movie guy.
All right. So top of your list, then, watch Rango.
People watch Rango. It. Yeah. Don't just watch Akira for the 23rd time like I did recently. No, I tried to watch there's a little Rango. I tried to watch more movies this year. That was my 2023 like goal after being like roasted for the friggin' for the John Carpenter thing. Yeah. And yeah. I watched the movies, but then I did. I also watched movies that I'm like, I probably shouldn't have watched. Like I watched good movies. Like I watched Asteroid City based on your recommendation.
Great movie.
But then the next movie I watched after that was the Witcher anime movie that Netflix put out. And it was.
Didn't even know they did that.
Not even that great.
Oh. Well, there you go.
So next part, though, is an interesting part of World War II history that Tristan didn't know. Now, I'm not a big World War II buff, so I'm not too surprised. But it's a thing that
Canada even participate in World War II?
Oh, hell yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. We joined, what's it called?
You're a part of the world, yeah.
We joined World War II about like 3 years before the U.S. did.
Well, it's not a race, Tristan, okay?
Yeah, Canadians joined in like 39 when the war started. Because of how silly Canada is, where we made a big deal about the fact that Canada declared war on Germany one day after the UK because we're so independent.
All right. So what did we get wrong here? What did you get wrong here? I'll live up to my Rango falsities.
Yeah. Okay. So one of the things that I did say in the podcast is that when Pearl Harbor happened, when Japan did the surprise attack on the U.S. base in occupied Hawaii, that Japan was at war with Britain at the time, fighting the British in China. I learned that was an unfact because Pearl Harbor was just the American side of basically like a coordinated mass attack that happened in early December of 1941, in which Japan did a sneak attack on both the Americans and the British. So Japan wasn't at war with Britain when Pearl Harbor occurred. They declared war on the United Kingdom on December 8th, 1941, after simultaneous attacks on British Malaya, Singapore, and Hong Kong, which happened at the same time as the bombing of the U.S. fleet at Pearl Harbor, or at least the day after. The Japanese invasion of Malaya began on December 8th of 1941, which is, I believe, the day after Pearl Harbor, and also invaded Thailand, which at that point was a British colony too, on the same day. These events marked the beginning of Japan's military campaign against the U.S. and European colonial possessions in the region, which before had only been a war against China, which was a very big and disorganized state and was in the middle of a civil war, or at least like the beginnings of a civil war when the war started. And the two sides of the civil war had to like temporarily call a truce to fight the Japanese. And then when the Japanese started pulling out of China, that led to competition over who was going to what they called like gaining the surrender or winning the surrender. So like when the Japanese would like hand over like a town or something like that, depending upon which side of the civil war it went to would fix things or would figure it out. And then, you know, one side was the Kuomintang, the sort of right wing military dictatorship of China. And the other side was the what would become the People's Republic of China led by Mao. So like spoilers onto which side won. I didn't know that Pearl Harbor was part of this like well-coordinated attack that was about the British and the Americans at the same time. And I think I also recall, and I don't know if it's part of this as well, but I think I recall also that at some point Japan invaded not Australia, but an island that was controlled by Australia. And Australia was also obviously like a big part of that war in the Pacific too. So
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's timed in with that as well. The thing, though, is that Pearl Harbor is most often remembered due to the timing, because it was first, and because, you know, President Roosevelt did the famous Day of Infamy speech. But it actually was part of a larger coordinated offensive by Japan against multiple targets. I think mostly because Japan was kind of running out of oil, and they needed to attack gas-rich parts like they needed to get the U.S. out so that they would stop embargoing oil so that Japan could have gas for its tanks and airplanes and stuff.
It's sort of like the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, where it's like we remember John Wilkes Booth and Abraham Lincoln, but there was like a whole coordinated strike for like three other people. But yeah, those other people failed.
Multiple parts
of his
cabinets. Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone else, I think, failed. It was only Lincoln who died.
Yeah. I think they try to kill Seward. They try to kill. I don't think they try to kill. I'm not going to say it because I don't know for sure. But
we don't want to do a corrections episode for a corrections episode.
We always end up having to do it anyway.
We always have to anyway.
But I'll keep going. But yeah, there was the assassination of Lincoln was a coordinated attack on like several members of Lincoln's cabinet and I think some like prominent Republican politicians that happened. And the president was like I think the only one that was actually successful. I think another one got injured, but the rest of them kind of failed.
Other people, another target I think was like left early or something. It doesn't matter. All you need to know is that it's all tied into some sort of secret cover up that was unveiled in National Treasure 2, Book of Secrets, where they find a golden city that is not El Dorado. We covered that in a different corrections episode.
Yep. Okay.
Anyway,
next one we got for this episode for the Battle of LA is that I talked about Japanese balloon bombs during World War II, and I said that Japanese balloon bombs didn't kill anybody, but they were like a thing people were worried about. And I found out that actually Japanese balloon bombs did indeed kill exactly 6 people on the American mainland.
Whoa.
And I apparently also missed the opportunity to talk about an actual military cover-up. So I looked into this. During World War II, the Japanese launched a balloon bomb offensive, which was known as Fugo, against the United States. So what they would do is they would take rubberized silk and put anti-personnel and incendiary bombs on balloons and then just drift them across the Pacific and have them drop
them
places.
Wild!
Crazy idea. The first operational launches took place on November 3rd of 1944, which is when, obviously when I was talking about Japan having an issue with having reliable access to oil, you can imagine how that would lead to this kind of offensive.
Oh, yeah. Just send balloons across the sea.
Yeah. And during that time, Japan, for about 5 months, launched about 9,000 balloons. About 1,000 actually even made it to North America, and only one resulted in a direct fatality. And it was 6 picnickers in Oregon who were killed on May 5th, 1945.
No.
And here's the thing, though. It wasn't because they dropped the bombs
Cinco
on them.
Cinco de Mayo?
Cinco de Mayo in the least Mexican place, Oregon, on 1945. But here's the thing. The bomb didn't like get dropped on them. Like there weren't like, oh no, there's ants all over our sandwiches. How could this day get any worse? And then what happened was apparently they found the bomb in the forest and dragged it out of the woods and it exploded while they were messing with it.
Yeah. Well, don't do that. I'm not going to victim blame here, but like, don't mess with a bomb.
Yeah. There's even a more recent example too, which is that in 2014, some forestry workers in British Columbia, i.e. like, people cutting down trees, which is a big thing that British Columbia does.
Sure.
They found one of these bombs that had not gone off and it was half buried in the mountains. So they had to send in a Navy bomb disposal team. And they did confirm that it was one of these Japanese balloon bombs. And this is in 2014. Why? Unfortunately, that was too dangerous to move, so they actually had to destroy it on site instead of like preserving it, because that would have been an interesting part of history. But that's that.
There might be more out there.
Yeah, I mean, they launched 9,000, and only 1,000 made it to the mainland. I don't know where the rest of them went, but
1,000 that we know of.
Yeah, that's wild. Like I did not know how extensive that program was. I had heard of it, and I did not know that it killed 6 people or even the 2014 incidents. That's pretty cool.
So they tried to cover up the 6 people that died.
I suppose so. I guess they wanted to downplay how they didn't want people in Japan or people in America to think that Japan actually did have hold threat over the Japanese mainland. Also puts a little wrench in the whole plan that there are Pearl Harbor truthers. I don't know if you know this. There's a conspiracy theory
that's annoying.
that basically the idea is that there's a conspiracy that Roosevelt and the U.S. knew Pearl Harbor was going to happen and intentionally didn't do anything to prevent it so that it would
they could justify
entering the war, which mostly comes from that people not understanding how radio communication networks worked at that time. And how time stamping and stuff works. But at the same time, you know, any large dramatic event in history always ends up being considered like a sort of false flag accusation.
Yeah.
And in this exact case, we see this happening again, and it is, it's a whole thing. But it shows like if they were, you know, trying to cover up dangers to the homeland from Japanese bombs, then that further solidifies like their motivations were not like if their motivation was for Americans to feel afraid and let us, you know, do like, you know, invade Japan for their oil or something. I don't know what, like whatever their thing, whatever their motivation was. That they would probably not have done that.
That's all. That is true.
We're moving on next to Foo Fighters.
Foo Fighters.
Yeah, Foo Fighters. So here's one thing that someone pointed out, and I looked this up and it is true. So Spitfires, one of the most common fighter jets, or not fighter jets, jets hadn't existed yet, but fighter planes, jets did exist. They were like prototypes. I know that someone was ahead of it. Yeah, they're very early jet engines during World War II, but they were experimental and they were not widely used, I don't think.
Spitfires were not jets. That's all you need to know.
Spitfires, not jets. But a group of Spitfires, which were like a very common fighter used during World War II. There's some recent HD footage of them taking off during an air show. And people have shown that when you see like the sort of chrome shininess of them in the sunlight, there's an optical illusion that makes them, especially when flying in formation, look a little bit like flying saucers, which could explain some of the Foo Fighter phenomenon.
That's interesting.
I learned that it's not uncommon for objects at a distance, especially shiny ones in the sunlight, to appear different because of light reflection and atmospheric conditions and perspective and stuff.
Yeah. That makes sense to me. I mean, we've talked a little bit about that in other episodes as well, about how the atmosphere and how light reflecting or refracting off of things. Like we talk about the ghost ships episode is a really good example of that, where ships can appear, or like things near the horizon can appear to be like floating above the horizon, like ships, and just because of the way that light acts. And it's really weird sometimes.
On that note, in that episode, we talked about sun dogs. Or no, that was the episode where we talked about the battle that happened, but the German thing from ages ago. But sun dogs are a common like atmospheric phenomenon that gets mistaken for UFOs, which is like when there's like ice in the sky that causes like these sort of rings around the sun.
Rings, yeah.
But a person who used to be an acquaintance of mine, but we haven't talked in probably over a decade, but we're still like on.
Okay.
We're sort of like mutuals on social media, basically.
You can just say my name, Tristan. I'm right here.
This is author Scott. Scott Sigler, a different Scott.
Different Scott. Gotcha.
He's like a horror author who got popular in mainstream. So he kind of like, you know, I haven't talked to him in a long time, but he posted a picture where he had seen a moon dog. Like he saw this like whole thing. Whoa. And I was like, hey, look, that's like a sun dog he posted the picture and he's like, isn't this crazy? And I said, yeah, it's like a sun dog for the moon. And then it turned out that the term for sun dogs, but for the moon are called moon dogs. So
that's great. Moon dogs.
The other thing too is that we talked about the Foo Fighters, the band, as a goof. And then
all I think about when we talk about Foo Fighters.
Yeah. And we kind of just talked about them like a regular rock band, and somebody did something. And I love the way that they talked about it. The language that the corrector used was very good, which is, I have to pull a Tristan and let you all know that the Foo Fighters have done horrible things. In the early 2000s, they supported and platformed an AIDS denialism group that claimed that antiretroviral drugs used to treat HIV actually caused AIDS. So I did not know
Jesus Christ.
And I had to look into it. So the band's bassist, Nate Mendel, did help organize a benefit concert for Alive and Well, during which the group's founder, Christine Maggiore, gave a speech promoting these exact views. Copies of Maggiore's book, which denies the link between HIV and AIDS, were distributed to people at the concert. And just so everyone knows, AIDS denialism, a belief system that rejects the scientific consensus that HIV causes AIDS, which is like one of the most extremely studied and understood phenomenons, because we've been trying so fucking hard to cure this extremely hard to cure disease. We do know that HIV does, if untreated or if not managed, does can result in basically your immune system collapsing, which is called AIDS. Some denialists even question that HIV exists as a virus, while others accept that it exists, but argue that it's either a harmless virus that doesn't cause AIDS, or sometimes they'll claim that HIV exists and was engineered by them, whichever them you prefer, to kill marginalized people. It's all nonsense. These views have been widely discredited by the scientific community.
Yeah.
And so if you are somebody who is HIV positive, please take your antiretroviral therapies, because people with HIV can live full and complete lives now. And as long as they have access to the medicine that they require. The thing about HIV as a disease is that it's more a test of a place's healthcare system and its social welfare system than it is like an untreatable disease, because it is a disease that, to avoid AIDS and to avoid dying of it, all you need to do is have regular access to antiretroviral medications. And if you, say, live in a country where healthcare is not free, you might not have access to said things. There's some issues of like HIV positive people, especially in the houseless community, still getting AIDS. And also people who are, there's like, because HIV originated in Africa, there are many African countries that have high HIV rates. And because their medical infrastructure is typically, because of the legacy of colonization and because they're not rich countries, their access to antiretroviral drugs are also limited, and it causes a lot of healthcare crises. So,
yeah, I mean, Emily and I are watching ER right now because we got sick of Grey's Anatomy, plus it's in between seasons. So we needed another doctor show to watch, and we're watching ER. And like the first two seasons that we're in have a lot of HIV and AIDS storylines, specifically about that exact thing, about like the doctors are like, you know, this was in the early 90s. So like even then they were just like, we're trying to still study and trying to figure it out. But when they did have treatments, there was a lot of, you know, it takes place in Chicago, and there's a lot of people who come in this fictional show, but based on real stuff, where they're just like, yeah, you just take these treatments. And they're like, but how much is that going to cost me? I can't afford that.
Especially in the early 90s, like AZT was like, I think, one of the most common antiretrovirals you could take at that period. And it was expensive. There was a time where if you were HIV positive, the medication you needed to not start to develop AIDS, like after possibly decades, because that's the thing about AIDS, is that it can show up. This is why people like kind of question the link, is because you can have HIV for decades before it starts to attack your immune system. And you won't really know unless you do a blood test, because it's completely asymptomatic otherwise. It's a whole thing. But
Foo Fighters.
Yeah. And also, I kind of just need to also point out that people who are HIV positive are still discriminated against fairly actively. And for all the people who listen to the show who are HIV positive, I hope for the best for you. I hope that you can get the medication that you need. And it sucks that people treat you like shit. And I want that to stop. Back to the Foo Fighters. They did distance themselves from Alive and Well and AIDS denialism afterwards. References to Alive and Well were removed from their website, but it's not exactly clear when they did this, and they have not publicly apologized nor acknowledged their previous support for these views since.
Oh, they're just trying to sweep it under the rug. They're like, that wasn't us. What are you talking about?
You don't worry about it. What was that? Never mind.
We're Foo Fighters.
Yeah.
You know Foo Fighters.
Remember Nirvana? We got a guy from that.
We're like them, kind of.
So this is, okay, yeah, 67. So we're talking about the Benny and Party Hill episode. So do you remember this statement that you made?
I do remember the statement that I made. And it looks like this isn't even a correction.
It's like an elaboration.
This is an affirmation that I did. This is validation that I said something correct. I like these.
Yep.
So this person writes in. So during this episode, Betty and Barney Hill, I said something along the lines of a saucer, like a thing that you would serve, like a little plate, a little dish that you would serve on a cup, like a cup would be on it. You know, people drink tea or coffee from a little saucer. The proper way in the past, the reason for that saucer was so you pour your tea or your coffee into the saucer, and it gives it more surface area to cool down. And then you would lap it up, like sip it up like a little dog, basically, or just sip from it.
So that just sounds clever. Like, why why did we like, well, I do know why we stopped doing that, but yeah, it's clever.
Cause it looks silly, but it is clever. And I mentioned that, like, imagine the founding fathers doing that. And you had said something, a joke about how, like, well, they were definitely not drinking coffee or tea. They were drinking something a lot stronger back then, but either way,
drinking punch.
Somebody wrote in and said, drinking coffee from a saucer was indeed the proper way to do it. At one point, you sip it from the saucer, same as you would a cup or a bowl. So I guess you don't lap it up like a dog. Mm-hmm. I just like that imagery. It's very funny. Can't find a good this person continues, can't find a good pick, but if you want a visual reference, George Hurst drinks it in that way in Deadwood. That's interesting.
I need to watch Deadwood.
I never watched Deadwood. Yeah.
It's the HBO hard-boiled Western show.
Cowboys.
Yeah, and it's got that guy from American Gods that I always forget the name of, but he's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I don't remember what his name is, but his name is Edward James Olmos, and it's not him.
Was the, Emily and I need a cowboy show. We tried watching Yellowstone, and we got through the first season, and then we went on Reddit to see, like, hey, when does this show get good? And a lot of Reddit posts about Yellowstone start with, hey, when does this show get good? To be met with a lot of responses of, what are you talking about? This show's great. It's not very good.
Oh, before we get approximately 12,000 comments, the person's name is Ian McShane.
Ian McShane.
Yeah. If you want to get one, this is the Western show I want to check out when it becomes available to you. You should go watch Django, the show that Abigail Thorne was on.
Oh, yeah. I'll do that. It sounds like Rango.
Yeah. Rango Unchained.
But there's no chameleon in it, I think. I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah, we haven't seen it yet. I don't know.
Who knows?
But yeah, drinking coffee from a saucer was indeed a common practice at one point in history. This originated because coffee used to be served extremely hot, because before percolation and all the sort of typical things, you usually had to, there wasn't as much control over how hot the water could be. So you had to basically boil water to make coffee.
Had to boil it.
I guess before then we didn't really know that, you can burn coffee. You have to get up to
water,
90 degrees Celsius, something like that, like almost boiling, but not quite boiling. But they had to boil water to make coffee. And meant that coffee was extremely hot. So pouring a bit of coffee into the saucer would allow the larger surface area to cool it faster, making it more comfortable to drink. This practice was not only efficient, but it was considered polite, more polite than trying to sip hot coffee directly from the cup. It was prevalent in many cultures, including Russia, Scandinavia, and England. In Sweden, for instance, people would purposely overfill their cup so that they could drink from the saucer, known as, and I'm sorry, Mia, already, dricka pabit, or drink with a lump.
Oh.
Just cute. That's a cute term.
That is cute. We need to bring back little saucers.
I like this concept. I feel like we should bring it back.
Little saucers.
I am a person. Okay, this is like a thing about me, and I don't know why. I have to make sure that I don't use the adjectives incorrectly. I hate food that is too hot. Note, I eat spicy food that is to the point where it can strip paint. I have eaten.
You don't.
I have
been temperature wise. You don't.
Temperature wise, yeah. Every time we eat, like whenever we have food, if it is like really, 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 really hot, where like it's like burn your mouth hot, it'll take me like six times longer than everyone else to finish it because I'm just like
Interesting.
So, in the context of the TV show Deadwood, George Hurst is seen drinking coffee from his saucer, which is not an oddity for the time, but more reflection of the practice. The art of drinking from the saucer was used in the show to contrast between Hurst and other characters who drank straight from the cup to show how prim and proper and etiquette he was.
I see. That's fun.
Yeah.
I like it.
The practice largely fell out of favor with the advent of coffee cups that had handles, and we kind of just accepted the concept of sipping coffee slowly to avoid burning ourselves.
That's fair. Less dishes to clean up, too. Mm-hmm. Fewer dishes. Sorry, pedants.
Yeah. And it's not standard practice in the US today, but some older people may still remember it. And in some cultures, people still do it.
All right.
So
I like it. Bring it back. I think we need to redesign mugs.
Maybe we should here in our like list of like imaginary merch, we'll have the It's Probably Not Aliens official saucer. And we'll just like make a saucer that's designed to fit your average coffee cup so that you can drink coffee from the saucer with a normal cup. Just like
and
how
if you store it upside down, it'll look like a little spaceship, like an alien flying saucer.
I would love that.
Right?
It's just like how I want to make, I don't know if you saw this, but for Christmas, Ancient Aliens released a Ancient Aliens branded whiskey decanter. And I want to make a It's Probably Not Aliens whiskey decanter stopper to put at the top of the decanter. Saying like this show is full of shit or something.
That's so good. It just says the word not.
Yeah.
like, you know,
exactly.
Not ancient aliens.
So on my list of increasingly ridiculous things I want to make podcast merch about that we can't because it would be really expensive and about 12
really expensive.
Human beings would buy
somebody
them and seven of them would
there.
Be me.
Somebody out there does stuff with pottery and clay that they could make little flying saucer, like some listener out there could make a flying saucer and send it to us. And then I could use it on every trip. I drink like tea or coffee every time we record. I would love to use it every time.
Yeah.
And send little pictures of it.
Yeah. So that was that. Love that little, see, this is fun. I feel like obviously you guys can tell I'm changing up the format to add a little bit more fun and context each one. And I feel like it's more fun.
Yeah.
It's going to be slower, but it's going to be more fun. Speaking of butts, let's move on to
yeah. Hit me with the butt.
Let's talk about the anal probing episode where we got a really awesome response to our talk about colorectal health, which is actually one of the parts of the show I'm the most proud of.
Good.
So this is from one of our older viewers who said that today, important to note, you don't necessarily need to get colonoscopies anymore. There is a new test that just requires a stool sample. If it shows anything, a full colonoscopy would be needed for confirmation. So I looked into this.
Nice.
And I found, I got with a yes, but with a but. This is a yes, but. So there are now non-invasive tests available for colorectal cancer screening that only require a stool sample. Now, there are a lot of reasons to get a colonoscopy that are not colorectal cancer screening, but that's a whole other thing. One is exactly as he pointed out, it's called the fecal immunochemical test, otherwise known as the FIT test. It's a test kit that contains materials that you need to collect a small stool sample from home, which you then
send. How fit is your butt?
Yeah. How fit is your butt? It's a butt fit test. You send it to a laboratory for testing. The test looks for microscopic amounts of blood in the stool, which is a common sign of colon cancer.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one that is also very, very cool, which is called the multi-target stool DNA test, or the mtsDNA, also known as ColoGuard, which sounds like the worst toothpaste ever. this combines the FIT test with another test that looks for altered DNA in the stool, which makes sense because if you have cancer, like if you have like cancer or pre-cancer, which is like cells that are likely to become cancerous in the future, like cancer is at the end of the day, a stockpiling of various mutations in your DNA. And your colon cells are obviously a little bit sensitive to these kinds of mutations, especially because you keep blasting it with all of those, sausage particles. It's apparently like something in like cured meat is really bad for it.
Oh,
yeah.
That's not good. Mm-hmm.
As a cured meat enjoyer myself, it's a very sad state of affairs. But but you can then test if a cell is precancerous, if it has like say a cell needs like four mutations to become cancer, you can test if it has like two or three of them and see how far along you are and remove those cells before they become cancerous and could kill you. So instead, you would do this test that would look for that DNA in your stool. You do this once every 3 years and it can be delivered by mail to the patient, which makes the test access basically unlimited because that you can literally do
that's
it from
awesome
home. You don't have to go to the hospital, you don't have to get
you don't need
anesthetic
an appointment
or anything. These tests are obviously less invasive and easier, but they have to be done more often, and also there's a big problem where they have a lot of false positives. If the result of the test is positive, a colonoscopy will need to be done to confirm the presence
double
of cancer
check,
or find the reason for the bleeding, because there are reasons that you can have blood in your stool that aren't necessarily cancer. It's definitely a red flag for it, but there are other explanations.
Yeah. Stress.
You did one of those things on TikTok that made the guy from the EMT guy just go, no. Have you ever seen that?
I know that guy you're talking about. I've not seen that specific.
It's one of my favorite bits on TikTok is just this guy who finds, because what happens is if you have a bit on TikTok, people can tag you in the comments. So now anything that is vaguely butt plug shaped or could be interpreted as butt plug shaped, he gets tagged in it. And it's just like them showing the thing and then it just zooms in on him and it's an EMT just being like, no.
Nope.
And he's got like a super thick New Jersey accent. It's great.
That's
and also
great.
Every person I know who works in the medical field, they love to talk about how many things they've seen in butts. So it's
people love putting stuff up their butts.
It's true. But things that they probably shouldn't put up their butts.
Just put the right things up your butt.
There are plenty of good things to put in your butt and you can get them. You could probably get them on Amazon now. So just like,
you can get them on Amazon. I was once sponsored by Adam and Eve.
Yeah. We're going for the colorectal health part to now move into like, hey, flared base, everybody. Get a flared base.
Flared base. Get the flared base.
And something that can be sterilized.
Yes.
So yeah, these are good tests. They're good alternatives for people who are unwilling or unable to undergo colonoscopy, but they're not perfect. False positives can trigger out follow-up colonoscopies. The sensitivity of the mtsDNA test for finding cancers is 92%, which is almost equal to a colonoscopy, which is about 95%.
Okay, but again, that's good.
Yeah, but again, because we're not the Joe Rogan podcast, we'll quickly point out that, you know, don't take medical advice from two assholes on the internet and instead talk to your fucking doctor about colorectal cancer screening options. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't listen to these assholes. Listen to your asshole.
The only person you should trust with your asshole is a trained medical professional.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Which we are not.
No. Okay. We're next moving into the spy balloon episode. So the emergency pod about the balloons, about Balloon Gate. You remember Balloon Gate? That was this year.
Balloon Gate was this year.
Yeah.
Jesus. All right. We have a lot from this episode. I think we'll probably end with this
episode.
With these.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
We'll end with these.
Especially right, because
I forgot about Balloon Gate.
Yeah. So this one
hit
came with a lot of me getting in a lot of trouble for talking about American military hardware, a common thing I get in shit for on this podcast.
You do. You do have lots of strong opinions about the U.S. military.
Yeah.
Specifically
military,
their hardware.
Hardware and about how effective the military actually is. So I said some stuff about the Osprey, or as I like to call it, the Marine Killer 9000, but people talked about it. So somebody mentioned that in past episodes that the Osprey was a disaster, and someone said they agree. In the first few years, it did have a lot of problems, but now it's turned into a regular, it has basically the same crash rate as a helicopter, which again, not great. Thanks.
Not good.
If you want to talk about how great helicopters are at crash rates, just take that to Kobe Bryant. Or,
oh no.
Yeah. Or like what's it called? Helicopters are not a great baseline to go off of, but either way.
Don't tell Harrison Ford about helicopters. Yeah, we will never be able to stop him.
Yeah. He's like, wait, they crash more? I can smoke weed and crash this one?
That's that has unintentionally become a bit on this podcast. Let's talk about how much Harrison Ford loves to crash planes.
It's true. And also, because I love that it perfectly pairs with the fact that he's known for smoking a prodigious amount of weed. So I feel like those are two are related. Okay, so let's talk about the V-22 Osprey, a machine that I constantly make fun of. It's a tilt-rotor aircraft developed by Bell Helicopter and Boeing Helicopters. And as pointed out, it has faced challenges since its inception, specifically with killing a lot of people and having a lot of technical problems. Because if you want to know what the Osprey is, it's a tilt rotor means you've seen these in science fiction all the time. Imagine an airplane, but like on the tips of its like little stunty wings are like two helicopter rotors that they can like lift up and then kind of turn into an airplane.
Oh, I've seen one of these. Yeah.
It's like the most common science fiction flying machine that you can think of.
Yes.
So during its test phase from 1991 to 2000, the V-22 Osprey had four crashes that resulted in 30 fatalities.
Jesus.
It only became operational in 2007. Since then, it's had 10 crashes, including two in combat zones and several other accidents and incidents that have totaled to 24 fatalities. So it's almost killed as many people during its testing as it has since it came out. To be fair, it's been like, you know, almost 20 years since the Osprey has been in regular service. There's that. And these incidents have led to concerns about its safety, and it has developed a controversial reputation as a result. However, the Osprey is extremely useful for some very unique things that it can do. It can take off vertically like a helicopter, but then have the speed and range of a conventional airplane once it has taken off, which makes it a valuable asset for the military. Despite the fact that it is tricksy, the aircraft does get used, and improvements are constantly being made to enhance its safety and reliability. For example, the Marines have been using analytics to reduce scheduled maintenance and spots emerging from troubled areas, and have improved mission capability rates by as much as 15%. So
that's not nothing.
Yeah. So they have improved safety on it, and there are various other attempts to improve its safety rating over time. Its readiness rate has typically been lower than traditional helicopters. This has actually improved. So that it was set at 82%, but the average was 53% from June 2007 to May 2010.
Okay.
So
small strides, you know?
Yeah. So the V-22 Osprey has indeed had a troubled history, and but it has also demonstrated that it has a lot of potential for military reasons. And so it has been improved over time to address many of its safety issues. And so that, you know, it's one of those things that, like, yeah, it started off really bad, but they have, because it's so useful, they didn't discontinue it and they've been trying to tinker with it to make it better.
Okay. Yeah.
The next part of
no more saying bad things about it, Tristan.
Yeah. The next part is that I mentioned that the U.S. doesn't do smaller drones. I talked about sort of the meta of drone warfare that's been unfolding in Ukraine, because it's one of the few places where modern countries with their drone technology are actually like fighting each other, because it's like one of the few conflicts on Earth where like big advanced militaries are actually going head to head through this sort of proxy conflict. And I said that the U.S. doesn't use smaller drones, but because, like, you know, the Russians are using smaller disposable drones that are made by that are made in Iran and can be made with, like, you know, $10,000 and with shit you can buy off Alibaba. Apparently, the U.S. does use something called Switchblade drones that were sent to Ukraine. But because the Ukrainians are not allowed to take pictures of it, there haven't been a lot of press about it. So I looked into this and it says, yes. And this part speaks a lot about the state of that war at the moment. So the U.S. has indeed supplied Ukraine with Switchblade drones. It's a loitering munition known as a kamikaze drone. So it can be remotely piloted towards and then detonated on impact. So imagine a remote control plane that then you can basically fly into something and explode. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's loitering, which means that they can, like, put it up in the air and have it, like, fly around until it finds a target and then go, whoo, and then go get it. They have been sending both the Switchblade 300 and the 600, which were developed by a company called AeroVironment, which is an American defense company. The 300 is a smaller, lighter drone that is designed for precision strikes against high-value targets with minimal collateral damage. It weighs about 5.5 pounds, and you can launch it from, like, a tube and can fly about 10 kilometers to its target.
Like a really high-powered t-shirt cannon.
Yeah, exactly. It is the deadliest t-shirt on Earth.
It makes that sound when you said, I imagine it makes that sound when you said it.
Exactly. It's perfect. Then the other model is the Switchblade 600, which is a larger, more powerful drone that's referred to as a tank killer because it has a more powerful warhead and is supposed to be equivalent to that of the Javelin, which is an anti-tank missile. It weighs about 120 pounds and can fly up to 90 kilometers. So footage has circulated online of Ukrainian forces using these Switchblades in their counteroffensive measures, which is troublesome because the U.S. Department of Defense has not publicly displayed that they are sending these drones to the Ukrainians. So the Ukrainians are not technically supposed to be having these because the U.S. isn't officially sending them. They haven't determined how many they've sent, but AeroVironment, the maker of the Switchblade, says that they are ramping up production following its use in Ukraine, especially the Switchblade 600, because apparently the Switchblade 300s did not turn out to be as useful as commercial drones because of the nature of the warhead, which is designed for minimal collateral damage, which means that it's designed to kill, like, you know, like, it's designed to be very precise. So it's not designed to, like, make a big explosion so that it can minimize the amount of people who might get caught in crossfire and such.
Mm-hmm.
The problem, though, is that it means that it's not very effective. It doesn't have a large area of effect, which could limit its usefulness. And in a full-scale war, that can be a problem. The 300s have been found to be inadequate. They lack an ability to hit hardened or armored targets. So anybody who's in, like, something like an APV or a tank can't really take it or can just kind of absorb the impact and not really take too much damage. The 600 is apparently supposed to be more effective. So I was going into the whole thing about, like, one of the things about the difference between, like, the drones that Russia is using and the drones that America is using is that the U.S. is using those Predators that have, like, that cost, like, $10 million each, and that the Russian ones are, like, 10 grand. This one shows that there's at least a significant come down. The 300 apparently can... one of those 300s costs about $52,000, which is about half a year at Harvard for a full ride scholarship. So every single one, I always want to point out when I talk about how expensive military hardware is, like, you should measure all of
it's
in
lot.
Full ride scholarships.
It's a lot.
Yeah. Because it has airframe sensors, integrated guidance, warheads, data links, and a launcher. But there's also a guidance unit that you have to use to operate it, which costs $30,000. And there are also reports that a single Switchblade 3000 could actually cost as little as $6,000, which would put it actually lower than the ones the Russians are using.
Interesting.
The cost of the 600, though, is not publicly known, but some budget documents suggest that it might be around $80,000, between $70,000 and $80,000. But these are just estimates, because obviously obviously for active, you know, in action military hardware, they don't exactly need this stuff to be super public, or at least they don't desire it to be super public.
Right.
Yep. I then got into more shit. Because I pointed out about, this is like one guy who sent like a really, really good email, just like completely just ripping into me about this stuff. So I talked about the U.S. having a war game with a fictional Iran where the U.S. lost badly. And what he was pointing out is I was talking about something called Challenge 2002, a war game where blue team lost in like military parlance. Blue team in war games is usually America, and red team is whatever the enemy is. Blue team lost, and which was restarted to not waste money on training. It's largely pointed out as a U.S. lost, and has argued that manipulation around it was a combination of trying to account for errors. So the idea is that the idea of Challenge 2002 is that America lost badly, and then they had to reset the test so it made it look like they would win. But it turned out it was a combination of trying to account for errors in simulation software, and the Pentagon was trying to make things look good. But the blue team definitely lost. So I looked into this and said the U.S. has run several war games with about a future conflict with Iran. Sometimes it has won, and sometimes it has lost. But the U.S. has not lost every war game against Iran.
Fair enough.
Yeah, and somebody pointed out that it's actually a waste of time to run war games where you always win, because that's kind of the point of them. There would be nothing to learn.
Yeah.
And it is a mistake to put losing one as ultimate proof that what future war would look like, especially one that's 20 years old, which is true. The exercise that I'm talking about, Millennium Challenge 2002, was designed to test a military future transformation, which was this like big change that was happening in the U.S. military, where they were trying to put new technologies and networked hardware into the war system. So basically, to have things more interconnected and test a lot of future weapons and tactics. But the exercise was controversial because Red Team, which was led by a retired Marine Corps general, repeatedly beat U.S. forces using unorthodox tactics. If I remember correctly, this involved suicide bomber speedboats. So basically like packing speedboats full of bombs and just driving them into battleships and stuff like that.
Okay.
And the results were allegedly scripted to ensure a U.S. victory, but it's important to note that the Millennium Challenge was not the only war game that had been conducted involving a hypothetical conflict with Iran. And there have been several other simulations, and their outcomes have varied. For example, a war game conducted in 2013 resulted in a challenging scenario for the U.S. with Iran imposing serious losses for U.S. forces. Another one in 2012 simulated the repercussions of an Israeli attack on Iran and forecasted a wider regional war that could draw in the U.S. and result in significant American casualties. Another war game conducted by the Brookings Institution had teams playing the roles of the U.S. and Iranian policymakers and presented a hypothetical scenario involving cyber attacks and assassinations, and the results of that were not encouraging was the result I got.
And I've talked on this show about how I used to work on this sort of stuff, right?
You did? You used to work on war game shit?
My first like official job was at Spaywar, and that's what we wouldn't run the simulations, but we were in charge of I only worked there for a month. So I have no secrets to tell, but my team, the team that I was a part of, I was the lowest member of this team. I was told that what we were doing was modeling, like we were doing 3D modeling for video game simulations for war game type stuff. I'm sure that's not actually how war game plays out like a video game, but that's the sort of stuff that we were doing was 3D modeling to 3D model cities that people would, that not U.S. cities, but other cities that potentially U.S. might invade or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's the sort of stuff that I was told that we were doing.
As far as I know, war games are kind of a mix. There are different types of war games, some that are more strategic, some that are more tactical. And oftentimes there's like a hybrid of like digital and real to sort of test out different systems and everything.
Yeah. I worked there for a month and I mostly just played Hearts, like the game Hearts that's installed for free on Windows. That's what I did. That's what I used the taxpayer money for, was for me to play Hearts for like 6 hours a day.
I guess it's better than simulating the destruction of other countries to serve the American Empire or whatever.
Yeah, honestly, I don't feel bad about it.
Yeah.
I don't feel bad about my time there because I did nothing. All I did was impede the progress, basically.
Slowly. Yeah. Another war game called Next War Iran also was a challenge who had to who had to do the attacking while a non-allied player defended its territory. But yeah, the US did lose Millennium Challenge 2002, but it is not accurate for me to say that the US has lost every war game involving a hypothetical conflict with Iran. The outcomes have varied, but I will point out that it's important to point out that a lot of the outcomes resulted in huge amounts of casualties, and that every simulation seems to point out that any war with Iran would be not a walk in the park, and it would result in some very, like, it would result in some horrible shit happening to the world. So
makes sense.
War turns out secretly is bad.
It's bad, it's big, and it's complicated.
Yeah.
We have four or five more to go through in this episode.
That is true.
We're already at an hour.
Okay, so we will pick up with more things that I was wrong about with military hardware in, I guess,
don't
April?
You fret. Don't you fret. Yeah. We got more wrong.
This is just a start. I think that the more context makes it more fun. We'll go through it slower and it'll never be ending. But I think that we
have
a lot more fun.
I like the changes that you've made to this format. I feel like we're learning more. Mm-hmm. There's more for me to get involved with and talk back at. I like it. I think it's fun.
I would have never known that you had worked in war game software development.
Huge asterisk, yeah. Being I played Hearts.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know the login to learn how to use what's that learning software, Lydia or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
It's like it was like a website that taught you all sorts of programming. No one told me the login to learn how to do 3D modeling, so I never learned and I just played Hearts.
I will say on that though, just because I always want to say, Lydia, which is now called LinkedIn Learning, is a really good service with a lot of free courses, or a lot of courses, and it's not free, but I have yet to see maybe this is because I'm Canadian, but I've yet to see a library that does not have a subscription. So it's very likely that your local library has a LinkedIn Learning subscription, and there are some very useful courses to take on there if you want to improve it. And because LinkedIn owns Lydia, the certifications that you get on it can go on your LinkedIn profile, which, as somebody who's currently looking for work, can add some value to your potential employability. So it's a useful service. Not that I love LinkedIn, but it's a free source of education, and obviously we love free education here.
We do love that. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this episode and for telling us all the stuff we got wrong. We do appreciate it, genuinely. Mm-hmm. We like doing these episodes. We like knowing that you are listening and holding us accountable for the things that we say.
Yeah,
so we
appreciate it. Yeah, you're our accountability buddies out there.
Accountability buddies. And a great place where you can send in corrections. I mean, you can do it on Twitter and Blue Sky at Probs Not Aliens. We also have a form that you can fill out some stuff over at probsnotaliens.com, I believe is where that is. Do we have a Blue Sky code for people?
I have several. You can. So here, free to a good home. If you want to sign up, you can go to bsky-social-kup5h-d2aid. So there you go.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And just tag us whenever you join.
Mm-hmm.
And Tristan, what else do you do?
Oh,
what else does your life have? You don't have anything else going on right now, right?
Ha! I have a YouTube channel called Step Back, and it's a podcast. Or no, it's a YouTube channel. This is the podcast where I talk about the past and why it's important for understanding. I try to give explanations for what the fuck is going on in the world. But doing so with using the past as a way to explain it, to give it some more dimension. Yeah. Scott, if I wanted to learn if whether or not Superman could reverse Earth spin and travel through time, where would I go for that?
That's a controversial video. That's on my YouTube channel, NerdSync, NerdSync. That's where I make videos about nerdy shit. Mm-hmm. That's my tagline now. It's
nerdy,
not really
shit.
But that's me.
I explore nerdy shit through creativity and vulnerability.
Comic books, superheroes, cartoons, all that good stuff.
Sometimes
I cover YouTube drama when YouTube's acting up and makes me feel unsafe in my own home. That's over all there. We've got links to everything down below. Thank you to everyone who writes reviews of this show and for being a part of our year last year and for listening to us and being a part of your Spotify Wrapped and all that good stuff. And just, it just means a lot to us. We've had a good time and we're going to keep having a good time.
Yeah. To 2024 and beyond.
And thanks for telling your friends about the show. All right. I don't have the thing in front of me that we usually say. I do. It's right here at the bottom.
Probsnotaliens.com. Leave reviews. Tell your friends.
Episodes early over on Nebula. Nebula.tv/probablynotaliens.
Mm-hmm. All those things. All great. So that's all for now.
So until next time, my name is Scott Nicewander.
I'm Tristan Johnson, and the truth is out there. I mean, eventually,
we might get it wrong.
I feel like American Military Hardware is going to be the new movies, but more people know about movies than American Military Hardware.
More people know about movies, but there are specific people who know a lot about military hardware.